Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Everybody, Eddie Trunk here, and it is time once again for another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday via podcast1.com and, of course, Apple Podcasts. Thank you for downloading and streaming and subscribing and checking it out each and every week around the world, wherever you are listening. It is greatly appreciated. And don't forget, as I say every week, this podcast, the interviews you hear on it at least, originate on my daily radio show on Sirius XM 106 volume. The show is called Trunk Nation. If you are in the U.S. or Canada, you can get Sirius XM. Become a subscriber. Even if you don't have a radio, you can get it as an app subscription only. And hear what I do every single day. Not just one interview or show a week, but you can get five shows a week. And you can hear them live I was just in the central time zone, so I'm saying 1 to 3. I usually just use the Eastern time zone, which is what I'll do right now. My show is live 2 to 4 Eastern, Monday through Friday, on Channel 106 on Sirius XM volume. And it replays every night 10 to midnight Eastern. And it also is on demand for you to listen to anytime you want if those times don't work for you, to download or stream on the Sirius XM app. So there's all different ways to listen. There is video content, all the interviews, full shows. It really is the best way to get what I do, and I appreciate you coming on board if you are not already. For my daily show on Sirius XM, you get a tiny, tiny little taste here on this podcast of what I'm doing on a daily basis on the radio show. Now, of course, if you're outside of the U.S. or Canada, you cannot get Sirius XM, so there's another way to hear what I'm doing. And to you guys, welcome, and thank you for checking out the podcast. But it's funny because I go all over the country, all over the world, really, and I run into people all the time, and they'll say to me, "Hey man, love the show," which of course I greatly appreciate, but I always have to say to them, "Which show?" And I'm not asking that to be a dick or be arrogant, but there's a lot of different things I do, and I just don't know what show they're talking about and what they're hearing. Could be this podcast, and there's some people that only know that. There could be people that listen to I have an FM syndicated show. People might be listening to that, or of course the Sirius XM show. Or they might be talking about shows I used to do, like, you know, That Metal Show, or maybe the show I was doing on Access TV, which unfortunately isn't happening anymore. Access TV was sold, folks, so I don't know what's going on there, unfortunately. But for those of you that watch Trunk Fest, I appreciate it. I have no idea why they don't show those shows. I just did a whole new season for Trunk Fest on Access TV, and every episode ran like twice. And it's gone. So I don't know. I have nothing to do with that stuff. I have no idea. It bums you out because you put so much work into this stuff and then it kind of gets buried. But I have no clue what's going on over there, unfortunately. But for those that watched, thank you, and I'll let you know if I hear anything in the future. But anyway, it could be that. It could be, you know, any of the things that I do. And so I never really quite know. I hear a lot of people that say to me, hey, listen to your stuff on YouTube. I've never posted anything on YouTube in my life. So I'm not exactly sure what they're hearing there, but something someone posted. Whatever the case, thank you for doing so, listening and connecting to my world. Social media, at Eddie Trunk, you know that, on Twitter, where I am most active. There is also Instagram, at Eddie Trunk. There is a fan page, which I don't do too much with, but that's there for you as well, on Facebook. And of course, EddieTrunk.com is my official online home, with my appearances on the homepage and music news updated daily. Things winding down kind of as far as appearances. A few more things to do between now and the end of the year, including coming up November 23rd. I'll be back in Tulsa at the IDL Ballroom, where I will be hosting a show with Vixen and the Iron Maidens. If you don't know about the Iron Maidens, they are an all-female maiden tribute that are really, really good. And them and Vixen will be performing at the IDL Ballroom in Tulsa, where I go so often and have so many great times, on November 23rd. And I'll be there hosting. Get your tickets now at StubWire. And just a few other little things that, you know, kind of wrapping up the year, believe it or not, already, of stuff coming up that I have on the docket. And that includes a trip to, hold on, I'm pulling up EddieTrunk.com to tell you where I'm going to be. That's why I tell you to check the site all the time, because I do it myself. I'm going to be at the Peacock Lounge in Erlanger, Kentucky, on December 14th, doing a speaking Q&A show that is just outside of Cincinnati. So if you're in that area of the country, please come say hello. Erlanger, Kentucky, Peacock Lounge, just minutes outside of Cincinnati, I'm told, December 14th. And December 20th in Clifton, New Jersey, in my backyard, pretty much, for the annual That Metal Show Christmas party with myself, Don, and Jim at Dingbats, where we always do it, in Clifton, New Jersey. Always a fun time. Bands play, we hang out. Should be an absolute blast, as it always is. So that's what's on the docket for the rest of the year. And there's one other thing I'm doing too, although it's not a public thing, and it's not a, it's not something that, an appearance of any kind. However, speaking of going outside of the country, I'm going to be going to Zurich, Switzerland in early December. Long story as to why that's happening, but it's going to end up being a family vacation for me. And originally there was supposed to be an event there that I was going to attend for Billy Gibbons, which has since been canceled. But since I had the plane tickets already, figured, what the heck? So me and the family are going to go over and visit that area of the world and spend a few days there, and I'm looking forward to it. If I have any listeners who are based in that area, and you got any tips for me or any suggestions, love to hear them, because I don't get over there. I've never been over there, and I don't know anything about it. I have no idea what I'm going into. All I keep hearing is how expensive it is to be there. So, I'll be there. And the funny thing about it, not funny, but interesting thing, cool thing, is I just found out Crocus is actually playing when I'm there, who, of course, are from Switzerland. And I had no idea that they were going to be playing there at the same time. Now, being that it's more of a family vacation sort of deal, you know, I figured, I don't know if I'm going to be able to break free to go to Crocus, but, you know, who knows? Maybe family's a little jet lagged. I get to get out and watch a little Long Stick Goes Boom. Who knows? But seriously, if you guys are, if I have listeners in that part of the world, email me, eddie@eddietrunk.com. Put Zurich in the subject, so I see it quickly. And if you got any tips or any suggestions, I'd love to hear it. I'm not even quite sure where I'm staying yet. You know, there's the hotel versus the Airbnb and all that. So that should be fun. Little vacation going to Europe, and looking forward to that, because so many of these trips, if you follow my schedule, I'm all over the map. I rarely get a chance to do anything with the family like this, so it should be interesting. All right, let me tell you, I got a few things to tell you about, and then we're going to get to our interview this week. But first, right now, I want to tell you about Pluto TV, because Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all completely free. Pluto TV, they never ask for a credit card. You don't even need to sign up to watch for free. How great is that? Pluto TV, it's the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies for free. So what are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again by downloading Pluto TV. You can download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today, including your phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, smart TVs, PlayStation, and anywhere else you stream.
Okay, parachutes ready.
Boy, the things I go through to get auto loan rates as low as 1.04% APR for 36 months on new vehicles with PenFed.
You are aware that you don't have to be a military member to save hundreds on your auto loan, aren't you? Anyone can join PenFed.
As someone terrified of heights, I probably should have looked into that.
Probably.
Drop me off at the shore.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/autos or call 1-800-247-5626. Advertised rates available through the PenFed Car Buying Service. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
So before we get to the interview, real quick, a couple things, because last week, Desmond Child as the podcast, I hope you enjoyed that. I love doing that. Really a lot of fun. This week, Billy Duffy of The Cult. This is an interview that happened in the SiriusXM LA studios a few weeks back. The Cult celebrating the 30th anniversary of Sonic Temple. They have some U.S. dates coming up that they'll be playing the album. So we'll talk to Billy Duffy of The Cult about that. I think you're going to enjoy that conversation. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Just a real quick rundown of my last week or so. It started in, speaking of travel, my last 10 days or so, started in Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. Heard a lot about the scare in the Dominican about people dying and people who have died there because, you know, tourists had issues or what have you, or liquor poisoned or whatever was going on there. I had no issue at all. I enjoyed it. It was a wonderful resort, all-inclusive resort that the event was held at, called 80s in the Sand, and very relaxed. It was like a cruise on land with alcohol included, but way more relaxed than most of the music cruises in terms of just a couple bands at night and everybody just chilling at the beach. Really great. It was great to be a part of 80s in the Sand. Hung with Sammy Hagar in the Circle, Lita Ford, the guys in Kix. Had a blast there. And I thank Steve Robinson and his crew for having me. Next year, that event is moving to Mexico. And they've already said they'd like me to come back and be a host for that as well. So I plan to do that. Really, really good people, good time, and good event. Many great fans that I met as well. From there, I went to LA, the Dio Bowling event. That was a blast. It was mayhem as usual. My team was indeed Geezer Butler, Brent Woods, Dave Grohl, Steven Adler. We didn't bowl too well, but we had a lot of star power. And there were a lot of people who got excited seeing all of those folks on my bowling team. So we had a good time there. It was good to hang with Dave some as well. And he told me new Foo Fighters record is in production. So look forward to that. And you probably saw some photos kicking around. More importantly, the biggest thing is money was raised for the Dio Cancer Fund, which is what it's all about. So thanks to Wendy Dio for having me out there in LA for that. I should be back in LA very soon. As a matter of fact, by the time you hear this, the date may be announced for the next broadcast that I do when I do my SiriusXM show Live from the Rainbow. And the next one is very possible to be next week. So please check my website, my social media, because it may already be announced by the time you hear this podcast. So, yeah, there's another trip. I thought I was winding down. I guess I'm not. So anyway, got in and out of LA pretty quickly and just went and hosted the Cancer Fund event. And then from there, I headed over to Houston, where just this past weekend on Sunday, I hosted the third annual Foam Henge, which was a lot of fun with my dear friend Ace Frehley, along with Accept, with my old friend Mark Tornillo in that band, of course, High on Fire, Power Trip, Pat Travers. Great day at Carbach Brewery in Houston. This is the second year in a row I've hosted that, and what a fun event. And thanks to Charlie Paulette and the entire crew there at Carbach, who were so cool to me and having me out there, Addy and everybody there, greatly appreciate it, and hope to be back. And they said they'd like me back for Foamhenge number 4 next year this time. But great time in Houston, and great to see all the bands. And I did spend some time with Ace Frehley, who has told me he has no idea about anything going on with Kiss and has not been contacted despite all the rumors that are out there. So there you go. Who knows? Whoever really knows what's going on with any of these bands. Hell, the Black Crowes reunited. Anything can happen. You know, it really is. It really is the Wild West out there. Everybody's reuniting. Everybody's going to go out there and grab that buck. Why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they? It's a crazy, crazy touring world these days. And at every level, by the way. So anyway, it was a great run that I just came off of a week and a half. Things kind of slowing down a little bit, as you just heard, a bunch of other stuff still coming up. And I hope to see you out there as we head into the holidays. It's already like 20 degrees here in New Jersey. It's ridiculous. All right, so Billy Duffy of The Cult coming up. And that's our interview. I think you're going to love it. I hope you do. If you're a Cult fan, I'm sure you will. So thank you for listening to the Eddie Trunk podcast. And please follow on social media. And stay warm if you're in the Northeast. And get ready for Billy Duffy coming up next.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, check this out. Hotboxing with Mike Tyson is coming to the Podcast One family. Listen as Mike Tyson, the baddest man on the planet, pours his soul into conversations with fascinating minds, celebrities, and athletes, along with his cosmic millennial sidekick and former NFLer, Eben Britton. Kid Dynamite dives deep into the issues impacting us all today. This podcast will change the way you see the world. Check out their first two episodes featuring Evander Holyfield and Tip T.I. Harris. Don't miss Hot Boxing with Mike Tyson every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome back to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Without further ado, let's get to our interview. Billy Duffy of The Cult. The Cult celebrating the 30th anniversary of a huge album for them, Sonic Temple. We talk about that and a whole lot more, including some upcoming live Cult dates. This interview, courtesy of my SiriusXM show, Trunk Nation, heard every day live on volume on SiriusXM channel 106. And here is Billy Duffy. Enjoy. What's up, Billy?
Rock and roll.
Good to see you, man.
Good to be seen.
How are you? We're live on the air, so go ahead and pull up a mic and we'll throw you right into it.
All right, okay, I like that. Live, exciting.
Exactly, live and...
That's good, I'll just put my motorcycle
out. Yeah. There. I see, yeah, you rode your bike, huh? That's the way to do it in L.A., I would think.
Around L.A. these days, it's ain't what it was, I can tell you, getting around.
Yeah, let me get you on mic so people can hear you. There you go.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hello.
So, yeah, how long have you lived in L.A. now?
On and off, I don't know, I've forgotten now. I think I came back in, 1999, and I've been here on and off. I'm actually spending more time in the UK now.
Are you really?
Splitting, yeah, I'm maybe getting a bit old for it or something, I don't know.
Where exactly in the UK?
I'm from Manchester, so I've got a place up in just outside Manchester.
Are you a US citizen or dual?
I actually have dual citizenship.
Yeah.
Which is very nice, worked for me very well.
Yeah, I bet.
I've been pretty happy with that. Yeah, I'm a dual citizen. I forget when I did that, I think 2011. Mm. And I got it the same day as Gillian Barbieri, that fantastic Canadian.
Oh, really?
Lady who was always over the news.
Yeah. Was she in the
3,000 people getting sworn allegiance to the flag? Yeah, I had to keep my fingers a little bit crossed on that one, being British, you know
right.
what I mean? I am deep down a red coat, so, you know what I mean? I am the guys that they warned you about.
But here in L.A., I mean, it's no joke. Like, the other day I had to go 3 miles. It took 45 minutes. I love it here. I come here every month, and I do love it here. I got a lot of friends here. I like being here. I like working from here. But, and you can't beat the weather, but man, that is it's not an exaggerated thing. That traffic is stupid.
I think nowadays you have to the way I'm working it in my mind is it I just not comparing it to what Los Angeles used to be. I accept it now for the new Los Angeles, which is, you know, more comparable to sort of more major urban areas. People used to come to LA because you could get stuff done, but it was chilled out.
Yeah.
And you could kind of relax and sort of, you know, the idea of California. That, I mean, that's done.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore here, really.
What's Manchester like these days?
Manchester, well, I spent the whole summer back over in the UK. It's very progressive. It's kind of, it likes to see itself as a kind of an arty town, you know, in the UK, sort of a let foot forward, you know, we're pretty progressive.
Is there a rock scene there?
I wouldn't say there's a rock scene. There was a pretty good music scene from punk onwards. Obviously, not. I wouldn't say there's really a great heavy guitar orientated rock scene, but more of an indie.
Mm.
You know, it's been very indie and sort of post punk was the thing. And then obviously the Manchester movement, which I'm sure you deeply appreciated.
Which is what?
People took a lot of ecstasy and danced all night in the late 80s.
Oh, yeah, that wouldn't be my word.
Well, I was flipping my long blonde hair on stages across America, having a whale of a time. Thank you so much. I was, there was a whole scene going on in Manchester about dance music.
Oh, I didn't know.
They would say, yeah, I know, it's not really, you know, we're kind of getting a little off-piste.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense of the scene, how it is there now, because... I mean, what was the last... I know a lot of rock bands came out of Birmingham, but what was the last big rock band? Was it Oasis, the last big rock band that came out of Manchester? They're from there,
so.
Right?
Yeah,
right?
I would say Oasis were the... you know, I mean, that's what... I mean, to me, they were not... I wouldn't ever have classified them as a rock band. I would think they were more of a kind of a pop, guitar-orientated band, you know. I mean, in the same way as you wouldn't say the Beatles were a rock band, would you? I mean, it's the song-driven. I mean, their first album was pretty rocking, you know, but, it was song-orientated. But that kind of music, you know, the heavy rock scene in the UK is definitely a little more subcultural. It's seen as a kind of a by-product. It's not really mainstream, although, you know, obviously, every so often Iron Maiden pop up and have a hit single in the charts because they've just got so many fans.
There they do, not even though they'll do arenas here, over there they actually will have hits, which is...
Oh, yeah, well, we did. We had like seven or nine. We had like nine top 30 singles, and I only used four chords. That is a joke, but I did use more, maybe seven. But there was less chords involved in getting nine top 30 singles for The Cult back in the day.
Yeah. Well, speaking of back in the day, hard to believe Sonic Temple is 30 years old. And I remember last I saw you was maybe a year or two ago. You guys played Rocklahoma.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was hosting it. We were at the Hard Rock, and we did that meet and greet. And I remember talking to you some then.
Yeah.
And you were, at that time, you had said to me, I said, what do you guys got coming up? And you said, well, I'm talking to Ian now because Sonic Temple's coming up on 30, and we're going to see if we want to do some sort of anniversary stuff for it. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's happening, and you're doing it. To me, it blows my mind that record is 30 years old.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. Is that because we look so fabulous?
I think so.
Is that why?
I really do.
Is that why?
I'm going to go with that, Billy.
I'm going to go with that one. I'm pushing that agenda. I'm just seeding that out in the world. They do look pretty fabulous considering they're nearly up for a bus pass.
I refuse. I throw the AARP envelope in the garbage every time I get it. I won't do it. Man. I don't care what the benefits are.
Yeah, man, oh, man, oh, man. I am, you know, yeah. I suppose I think that it's wise when everybody reaches a certain age, and I would guess that's somewhere over 50, to not start playing the numbers game.
Mm.
It's a little, because it's not a winning mathematical formula.
Yeah,
if you project, say, ahead as far as we're talking back, then it's not a pretty sight, you know. At the best, you're going to be the juice guy in a onesie with a little belt buckle pulling yourself up and down because you're living on, like, kale and Swiss chard, you know, and you're 97 and you don't look a day over 85, and who cares at that point? You just want to make it to the toilet on time. You know what I mean?
That's... I am of the belief, strongly, that what we do you as a performer, me on my end of it and being out there all over the place, does keep you young. I do believe it does, even if not physically, mentally. I do. I see so many people. I'm 55. I see so many other people that are around my age who are look like they're ready for the rocking chair and feel like it.
Yeah, no,
and I mentally and physically feel like I'm 25 still. I'm like ready to go.
Well, we're kind of lucky. You know, we're blessed. We've had a good, both of us have had a good, you know, life, you know, and I think my mom said something to me very profound once. She said, Billy, as long as you've got your health, nothing else really matters. And I was like, very wise words, I think, from my old mum, my old Betty, my mum.
Yeah.
I think she was pretty bang on with that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think we're just very fortunate. We're blessed. And I think that definition of when you're a youngster, you know, and I was panicking when I was a kid because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was reasonably intelligent. The 70s were terrible in England. There was, you know, punk was happening. It was a very depressed environment. And I didn't know what I wanted to do in my life. You know, all my family were in the building trade, so that was the most obvious route for me, you know, and I just didn't fancy working outdoors 5 days a week in the English weather. And, you know, thank God for, you know, the Sex Pistols. That's all I can say, because, and the Buzzcocks and that whole thing, because that, for me, you know, took, I mean, obviously I was into music as a kid, and I, all the rock bands and everything you probably grew up liking, because we're not too far apart in age.
Right.
But it was a fantasy. If I was aspiring to be a guitar roadie for the local second best rock band in South Manchester at the time. You know, that was an aspiration. And then punk happened and suddenly the whole game changed. You know, I mean, a lot of things remain the same. You know, the major established bands, you know, they were nervous for 10 minutes and then they continued to sell out, you know, flying private jets and do what they did. But for a year or two there, it was pretty exciting, heady times in the UK. And it did open a lot of possibilities where suddenly it was like, oh man, yeah, why can't I be in a band? And, you know, you take that, what is in fact a monumental leap. It might, a stage might only be 3 or 4 foot high, but standing, watching somebody and climbing up and doing something and entertaining people, it's like Everest.
Yeah.
To some people.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's quite a significant thing. Anybody can do that.
You said you weren't sure what you wanted to do.
Well, you know, career-wise,
right,
until music. So punk was the thing that, like, I found myself in a band by accident, almost. I literally was trying to be the 16.
What was that band called?
Well, it ended up being called the Nosebleeds.
That's
yeah, yeah. Well, it was, sort
for
of.
A punk band.
And ironically, and this is, I do tell this story a lot and I'm getting a bit bored of telling it. Ironically, I happened to have a friend who I was going to gigs with because we liked all the same kind of music, like the New York Dolls and Patti Smith and the Stooges. His name was Stephen Morrissey. And I got him to sing and wrote the first songs with him he ever wrote. There was, if anybody's remotely interested, they did make a movie that's on Netflix called England Is Mine.
Oh, and really? Is it a documentary?
It's just, no. It's kind of, what is it when it's very close to the truth, but it's not a documentary?
Biopic?
Yeah, biopic.
Like the Queen movie?
Yeah, it's a biopic.
Right, okay.
It's a biopic. Okay.
And how long ago did it come out?
About 2 years ago. It was a low-budget thing in England. Actually, Brian from Cleopatra Records out here in LA, who helped finance it, and one of the guys from The Cure put some money into it, whose name escapes me. It was an indie movie, and it just happens to tell the story of Morrissey when he was Stephen Morrissey up until the minute he meets Johnny Marr. It's not about the Smiths. It's not about that. It's just a fun little thing about the Manchester music scene right when punk was happening, and I happened to be in it, and I happened to have introduced Morrissey to Johnny Marr for...
Is somebody in the movie playing you doing that?
Yeah, he's like my little son I never had. His name's Adam, and he's like a great guy, and people say he looks exactly like I did when I was 18.
Wow.
Bless him. Wild. And I'll be seeing him in England. He's coming to one of the gigs. He's become kind of a friend. You know, I've got a great daughter, but I never had a son, so I'm like,
there you go.
You know, Adam's like my adopted son. I'm going to have to take him in if his acting career doesn't. He was in Peaky Blinders for 5 minutes.
Okay.
So he's got the right haircut.
If you had not made it in music and as a guitar player, songwriter, performer, you said your family was in building.
But yeah,
did you personally have another a fallback thing? Like, was it sports or acting, or was there any other thing that you saw yourself potentially doing if it wasn't this?
No, I wasn't good enough at football, soccer, right, as we say over here. My American side, right, said, right, soccer. I was just borderline good enough to get in the team. You know what I mean? I was like sometimes on the bench, sometimes I was a starter, which I'm constantly reminded of because I think I got better as I got older because everybody else stopped playing. No, I didn't have a backup plan. I was filled with 10 different kinds of fear. So I ended up working in a hospital as a porter, which is a great gig for a, you know, young guy with an idea to make a music career. But
well, because the hours are probably your flexible hours.
I was doing night shifts, doing full day shifts, which would give me a couple of days off so I could go and do gigs with bands. And
right,
that's actually happened. But by that time I'd moved to London. But yeah, you know, I mean, that was post-punk. That was more like 79, you know.
When the punk scene happened, what do you remember the first time you saw one of the bands? Do you remember what you first...
I know. It's all indelibly imprinted in my mind because I just happened to go to see a gig that was the first ever show the Buzzcocks ever played, period, their debut gig. Uh-huh. The next band on were a local band from South Manchester where I grew up. They were called Slaughter and the Dogs, which you can tell by the name. They were basically kind of a Bowie-esque rock band. Well. And when punk happened, they just sped all their songs up. Seriously.
No, they were really they glammy like Bowie?
Yeah, and then Mick Ronson produced their debut album.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Ronson was friends, and I'm still friends with the guys in the band, and we go back a lot longer than Sonic Temple. But they were next on the bill, and then finally the headliner was Sex Pistols.
Oh, wow.
With, you know, before Sid, it was the Glenn Matlock, the OG 76 lineup.
Right, right.
And it left quite an indelible print on my mind. I started shedding some rock albums at that point that I felt might be superfluous. I didn't let go of my Montrose first album, though.
I'm wearing a Montrose shirt that Billy's pointing to.
Yeah, yeah, right, yeah.
Which it's crazy about this Montrose album, and I've said this to Sammy Hagar and a lot of people. This... the other day I was talking to Joe Elliott about this. He was here as well.
Yeah, yeah.
The Montrose record, the first record, is way more of a bigger deal with British...
Yeah, we loved it.
...folks than here in America. That album, like Iron Maiden covered Montrose tunes. Like there was a huge impact from this record. A Southern California or California band in England, here people kind of... know it, but in England, Montrose was a really impactful record.
Isn't it a strange thing how sometimes, and that's not without precedent, you know, I mean, like, for example, the Stray Cats.
Yeah.
England. Jimi Hendrix. England.
Well,
they were recognized in the UK before they had any success in the States.
Right, but the thing with the Stray Cats, I mean, that record, I worked in a record store and that record came out. That thing was an enormous seller. It got all the MTV attention. What's really fascinating to me when you talk about how things are perceived in England versus here in America is you look at a band like T-Rex.
Yeah.
Here, it's one song.
And we all know what song that is.
Right. Bang a gong.
Yeah.
In England, there was a term for it, T-Rex to see, because it was such pandemonium.
Yeah.
Influenced, Mark Bolan influenced Bowie.
Absolutely.
Thin Lizzy. Here it's one song, maybe two. There it's a whole different thing. It's really interesting how that sort of thing happens. And then you reverse it in something like Montrose, which in the big, you know, for the most part, is kind of off the radar here in the U.S., a celebrated influential record in England.
Absolutely. It's one of the pillars of, you know, considered for my age group, like say Joe Elliott and the Iron Maiden guys, we're all probably roughly the same age.
Right.
And I mean, I went through some stuff. Funnily enough, I'm having a bit of a clear out of my memorabilia soon. I'm just having one of those zen moments where it's like all this stuff's got to go.
Where are you going to go? What are you going to do with it? Are you going to sell
it? I'm auctioning it off and giving some of the proceeds to charity. And as I point out, if I'd have written Dark Side of the Moon like Dave Gilmour, I'd give all the proceeds to charity,
right,
but I didn't.
Gilmour just millions of dollars in guitars. Yeah, exactly.
I'm just a mere mortal
guy. Just
a
man riding his motorcycle in LA.
You know, I'm just a guy from Manchester who got lucky. So, you know, but I'm giving some of the proceeds to charity. I'm getting rid of the stuff. But in all, when I went through that stuff, I go back to my childhood. I've got tickets, some gigs I went to in the 70s and And, you know, there was a lot of that early and scrapbooks. And there was cuttings from the music magazines with pictures of Montrose. So for me to end up playing with Ronnie Montrose and Sammy Hagar doing two tracks off Montrose's album years ago when Sammy opened a place up in Tahoe.
Yeah.
And I'm on stage and I'm talking to like Ronnie Montrose and we're rapping about guitar, you know, minutiae. Like, yeah. You know, he was like, oh man, I invented the kind of heavy bottom strings but light thin strings so you can bend the leads but you get a good, I'm like, wow. And just hanging out and just being as like an equal to somebody who, as the 14-year-old me, cut them out of a little newspaper and stuck it in a scrapbook.
Yeah,
it's kind of a trippy thing, man.
You said you saw, you mentioned the New York Dolls a second ago. Yeah, did you see them live?
No, I missed them. I was kind of young, you know, the Sex Pistols gig was kind of a fluke. I missed a lot of gigs. I was a bit young for Alice Cooper School's Out Tour. It did Manchester. Bowie did, like the 73, 70, 72, 73, I was too young.
Right.
I was only 12.
Right.
You know, I mean, I did go to a gig when my dad took me to see, and you're going to love this, Suzy Quatro.
Mm-hmm. Who never made it here,
no,
but
Suzy
there.
Quatro opening, right. Thin Lizzy with Eric Bell, three-piece, oh. pre Whiskey in a Jar.
Pre-Scott Gorham.
Oh, yeah, before all that.
Yeah.
Slade were the headliner, who I might point out were an excellent, excellent rock band live.
Well, that's another band.
Yeah, yeah.
Slade, here in America, they're known because Quiet Riot had a hit with one of their songs.
Yeah, people think it's Quiet Riot.
Yeah, nobody has a clue about Slade in America, but very celebrated band in England. Status Quo, same
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah. They had a lot of hits. A lot of hits. They were all very much the fabric of the 70s. So I was a bit young for 72, 73. My era was more 74, 75, 76. Those kind of bands. So I saw Lizzy.
Did you see Kiss early on? Did they
no,
mean anything
to you? No, I never saw
you?
Kiss. I didn't like Kiss at the beginning.
Right.
And I've subsequently met the guys and they're great and I've played on stage with a couple of them and stuff. But at the time, I just didn't get it.
Right.
It just wasn't. Because we had Alex Harvey, Sensational Alex Harvey Band. We had, you know, there was stuff that resonated with me.
Right.
And I just didn't get Kiss. Because I honestly, at the time, didn't. I just was like, I don't equate. I just didn't get the makeup and the whole thing.
Yeah, I was curious about that.
The showbiz thing a bit, I didn't.
Right, because when you talk about these really important, impactful moments for musicians, at least, I don't know how that worked in England, because here in America, maybe 80% of people that I'll talk to that are in rock bands will tell you that was the scene around my age, our age, that was a pivotal moment for them. Just about everybody I've had in here this week has said, oh, my first show was Kiss or whatever. That set me
and
so I was curious if it connected like that in England.
There was actually a bass player in my high school band was into Kiss, and he was the only guy I knew that liked them. And
yeah, I don't know if they came over before probably 75 or 6 either.
No, they didn't.
I mean, they started here in early 74, but I don't know if they would have even gone to England for a year or two.
I wasn't aware that they played over there. It
yeah.
wasn't just, to me, like we've discussed, we had Slade, we had Bowie, we had T-Rex, we had Thin Lizzy. There was countless bands touring. And Kiss, to me, I just didn't get the whole...
Right.
You know, thing. I'd see.
Oh, no, it's with them. It's very much a love hate thing. There's or not. I know. I'm not saying you hate them, but I'm just saying you either loved them and were all in, and it was your world, or you didn't get it, and that was not uncommon here in America. It still is, actually.
Yeah, no, I know
very much so. So Billy Duffy is here from the Cult. It's the 30th. Anniversary of Sonic Temple, a huge record for them. Four big songs on it.
Yep.
We'll talk a little Sonic Temple.
Yeah.
There's a special edition that's come out or coming out.
Yeah,
shows announced. About 7 or 8 here in America, but others outside of America as well, as the band celebrates the 30th anniversary of that record. So we'll get into a little bit of that with Billy.
Okay, parachutes ready.
Boy, the things I go through to get auto loan rates as low as 1.04% APR for 36 months on new vehicles with PenFed.
You are aware that you don't have to be a military member to save hundreds on your auto loan, aren't you? Anyone can join PenFed.
As someone terrified of heights, I probably should have looked into that.
Probably.
Drop me off at the shore.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/autos or call 1-800-247-5626. Advertised rates available through the PenFed Carbuying Service. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
Let's get back to more of my conversation with Billy Duffy of the Cult on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. So what is in this package? Because you were just telling me that you did do the cassette too. There is a cassette in there, right?
I believe. I mean, I haven't seen it yet. That it's out, and parts of it have sold out. So when the label said it's a limited edition, they weren't joking.
Right.
It is a limited edition because you can't charge like premium money for a thing, you know, and say it's a limited edition and then just flood the market with them. So parts of it have gone. They're done. They're sold already. Yeah. So, but we did cassettes as well because Ian really was like into the idea and, you know, because that's, you know, what's going on.
What's on the cassette?
I believe we put some of the demos because we wanted to put out everything we had on Sonic Temple because it's just for the fan. It's a fan driven thing.
Was there a lot that was left off the record or things that were, how much content is there beyond what we actually heard?
There was
on the record?
A lot of content because Bob, it was the first album that Bob Rock produced with us. He was very thorough about demoing before we went in to do the album. So there's an entire album of demos with Eric Singer, speaking of Kiss.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's two drummers and Chris Taylor, who was in Bob Rock's band up in Canada. But Eric was on a lot of the demos as well.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So, for example, there's that. But then we put on some of the songwriting demos and the rehearsal room demos where we're just woodshedding ideas in the room as a band.
Uh-huh.
It's all in there. Some of it came out many years ago. They did a very limited thing called Rare Cult, which was like a box set. That was released possibly 15, 20 years ago, and some of it appeared on that.
Right.
But there's definitely stuff in this package that's never been out before, and we were just like, it's that time, you know, here it is. Here's everything, you know. Because it's a fan-driven thing. I mean, I don't particularly need to hear it. Do you know what I mean? I'm not going to sit at home playing my own record while lighting some candles and, like, enjoying my brilliance, having a little date night with myself. I mean, it's, you know, it's not. We put it out for the fans. It's good. You know, it stimulates them. It makes the gigs kind of a celebration.
And it commemorates a really, really important record in your history.
Well, and also more importantly, from my perspective, and I think that's where me and Ian kind of agree, is that it's almost like it's more like a very important album for them because it was a fabric of their lives. I've got albums that I grew up with that was so important to me as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old. I understand that people grew up listening to Sonic Temple or Electric or Love for the Cult. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
I'm trying to say it's like it's not about how great were the Cult. We're just two guys that we do our thing, and you know, it's about the fans. It's fan driven, and you know the demand's there for it, and that's why you know we put it out, and it's been really successful, and the gigs are all selling out, and.
And I've heard, by the way, I've heard nothing but amazing things about the gigs. Everybody's saying the band sounds incredible.
Lineup.
The vibe is great. Everything is just the set list. Everybody had dinner with some folks last night and they were just carrying on. They'd seen you, I think, at, I don't know if it was Hollywood Bowl or
oh, we did the Greek. That
the
was
Greek
a great
here.
Night.
And they were just raving. And they said, well, you talked to Billy. It was the best show we ever saw from the Cult. It was phenomenal. People just loving what you're doing.
We got some very positive feedback. Our manager, Tom, Vittorino's got to take a lot of credit because he said, you guys are doing the Greek in a year or so. And I was like, you know, we ain't doing the Greek. We'll never do the Greek.
Because you thought it was too big?
I thought it was a little big for us. You know what I mean?
What's the capacity there?
I think 6,000.
Believe it or not, I've never been there in all the years of coming out here. I hear it's an amazing venue.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's tremendous on one of those Southern California nights if you get that kind of magical.
Right.
And we got lucky, you know, and it was great and it was a sellout and everybody had the right mindset, you know, to enjoy such a great night and the vibe, you know, the vibes were great. So very life affirming, you know.
How do you feel personally about Sonic Temple as a record where it slots in for you as the records you've made with the Cult? Do you feel it's your best record, one of your best records?
It's a great question. Well, we were fortunate to have three, Love, Electric and Sonic Temple, that were like one after the other. It was kind of a good combination of punches. And you know, it was over a sort of 6-year span of constant writing, recording, touring, recovering. You know, we hadn't got to the rehab phase. So we just, to me, my view on Sonic Temple was that I just wanted to make a no holes barred, no excuses, no full-on, fully realized rock album with the Cult. Mm-hmm. Not like, oh, well, you used to be a goth band, so you can't do this, or you can't have this, or you shouldn't do that. It was just like, we're going to write the best songs we can write. We're going to make it sound as big and magnificent as we can. And that's all I worried about. And that, to me, is what we did. Ian viewed it possibly a little more psychedelically, and that's where, like, a producer like Bob Rock would come in and try and marry, possibly, it's just language.
Right.
We both had the same vision. He was more like Disraeli Gears, or that's where his head was at.
Right.
I was more like a, you know, more like a kind of a, if Queen and Motley Hoople had actually formed one band, you know, a tough yet progressive record,
right,
with some soul, you know, because that's the thing about The Cult. And one of the reasons, you know, we always aimed our music from the waist down. You know what I mean? A lot of, you know, that's the thing. People, what kind of band are you? We're like a...
Scott Ian's walking in right now.
It's not. Oh, that's the next shift. Don't wear
exactly.
me out. Wear me out. Hi, hi.
He's
hi.
Coming in. He's coming in to steal all the questions.
Yeah, yeah. He's making notes. It's not. You're not. Yes.
Turn him. If you figure out, turn a mic on, Scott. Feel free to do it. I don't have a.
Figure out.
That, just
be here till the end of time.
Yeah. Spoken like a true guitar player.
Exactly.
I'm a technophobe.
So we were just talking about your thoughts on Sonic Temple.
So, yeah, and we were just aiming, you know, rhythmically. One of the things with The Cult was always trying to make sure it had a swing feel. And I mentioned Eric Singer before playing on the demos.
Yeah, I had no idea about
right,
that.
Okay, so, yeah, you know, just wild. A piece of rock. He's a friend, yeah, and yeah. He's still a mate. He's actually, funnily enough, the same birthday as me. And
really?
He's exactly the same age.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he's a very dry character. I like it. He's got a great sense of humor. Anyway, we digress. But Bob was really adamant that he wanted a certain type of drummer to play the music once we'd written the songs, and he didn't feel Eric was quite right for the feel of what we were going for. So we got Mickey Curry, who was, he still is, Bryan Adams,
right? Yeah.
But his background was Hall & Oates, so he was more like a swing rock drummer, you know.
Right.
So that's who we ended up using on that album and then the next album.
And what about Bob Rock coming in? Because as you mentioned, Rick Rubin had worked with you previous.
Yeah, on Electric.
And then you would Bob Rock, who obviously at the certainly still a major producer, but at that time certainly the guy, one of the biggest names as far as rock is concerned. How did you end up working with
him? No, he was a little name.
Well, because Black Album and all that hadn't happened yet.
No. He hadn't done Metallica.
I think he had done Kingdom Come.
He did Kingdom Come. That was it.
Did that record have anything to do with using him?
Well, there was a lot of things about that record that were good, and there were several things about it that weren't good, in my opinion, in terms of...
sounds.
Content. No, the sounds were good.
Yeah.
And that's what we liked. We thought it was... Remember, I wanted to make... Because Electric was kind of like quite a basic 24-track... You know, we recorded and mixed it in the same studio. That we, you know, there was no frippery with that. Rick did his thing, very minimalist. With the next one, I wanted it to be a fully realized... We felt we'd left a little bit of something behind when we did Electric. It was like a moment, and it captured where we were at, which was basically like a bunch of drunken pirates having a good old cartoon lifestyle because we'd had some success. But Bob felt that we'd left a little bit of the... something that made The Cult special on the Love album behind. So his thing was to try and combine elements of Electric and Love. He kind of was a fan, really, Bob, initially. But he hadn't produced any quote-unquote big bands.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the timeline because we're talking 30 years and that was
89.
It
was 88 when we recorded.
Yeah.
And we were writing songs early 88 and all through the summer of 88 and we got Bob on board. I jammed with Bob's band in Vancouver because his guitar tech... A guy called Laird somehow was my drinking buddy, and we used to go to the strip clubs in Vancouver a lot together. And he said, "Oh, you got to meet my boss. He loves your band. He's constantly playing your albums." And da da da. And I had no idea who Bob Rock was. I didn't know he'd had a band. I had no idea because Canada's music scene somewhat doesn't always bleed across the border,
right?
And I had no idea who Bob Rock was. And then we talked about Kingdom Come, and I kind of had heard that record.
So did somebody, was it a label guy or somebody that put him into the consideration pool to do Sonic Temple?
No, it was me.
It was you?
Yeah.
So from that meeting and then having
heard
Kingdom Come.
Hanging out, jamming, pretending I knew a Beatles song and walking on stage drunk in 1987 in Vancouver, playing with him wearing, I might have had a headband on. I don't know. I'm still having therapy on that one. I think I had like some kind of headgear that was atrocious. But anyway, so from that, yeah. And in credit to Ian Asprey and our managers at the time, because we'd had success with Rick. We didn't have a problem with Rick. My gut was that we couldn't repeat that trick twice.
Right.
And I just met this guy and he talked a great game. And Ian was open-minded. And he was like, if you really believe in this guy, then let's pursue it. And that's what we did. I just really believed in Bob Rock in 1988, based upon what I'd heard and meeting him face-to-face and hearing how he perceived the cult. And, you know, and we've done sort of four or five albums with him since then.
To me, looking at it from the outside and having worked in rock, worked in rock radio at that time, it was to me, Sonic Temple was the culmination of the records that came before it. It felt like it was all leading that way.
Absolutely, yeah.
With Love and Electric, it was like, okay, there's She Sells Sanctuary and all these things that we started to hear on rock radio.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, boom, here comes the whole thing coming. The sound, the... everything.
Yeah, no, it was. It was a bit like, I was a little bit at that point careerist and driven, and I was bound and determined to have a platinum album, because Electric didn't go platinum originally, initially. Went gold, did great.
Good luck getting one of those now.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. Well, you get balsa wood and teak. But anyway, so I was a bit, and we'd got an American manager. We changed management. We got established in Los Angeles. We got, you know, a big time American manager, and we just made a good go. We sort of went for it, to use the terminology, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, if you're being smart, you don't try an untested producer. You don't get Bruce Fairbairn's assistant. That's who Bob Rock was.
Right.
Bob Rock cut his teeth engineering
Bon Jovi,
Aerosmith, right, whatever, with Bruce Fairbairn up in Vancouver, mm-hmm, and eventually started branching out, as you do, on your own.
Yeah.
I just think it was important also that Bob's a musician and a guitar player, and I think it's important for the cult to have a producer who's a musical guy. There are many kinds of producers. You know, Rick Rubin's incredible at what he does. He was the first to admit he's not a musical person.
Right.
You know what I mean? He's not
a
tell
Zen
you,
master.
Yeah, he just sits at the back and it's either cool.
I saw the documentary, cool. That's why I know. If you've seen the doc, yeah.
Yeah, you know. Well, I lived the documentary, didn't I?
Exactly.
I was in the documentary.
Billy Duffy is here. Sonic Temple, 30 years old. The dates, there's here in the U.S., there's only about 7 or 8 that you've announced, right, left
yeah,
for the year?
Yeah, we did, yeah. We don't really tour in a kind of the sense that we did 30 years ago, where you start on one point on the map and keep going until you've done, you know, 6 months of that grind. I don't think we have that. We just get groups of dates together now. We'll do Weekend Warrior stuff and fly. I'm sure Scott can relate to how, yeah, you know,
but he doesn't. Those guys, Anthrax still goes out, go out for do, oh God.
We don't, we see, we don't, and I don't think we've got the desire. We like to play, but we like to do it in little bursts these days,
right?
You know, the idea, I mean, Ian's really not that keen on touring. I'm a bit more of a road dog. He does it, but I think if he was being honest, he doesn't love the notion of, you know, sitting on a bus,
right,
with a bunch,
well,
everybody
of has their process and finds a way to make it work.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Well, for the cult, it's just we're trying to do little and often rather than extensive, you know.
Right.
So this is a cluster of dates between Washington and Boston.
And I actually believe that sometimes, I believe that some bands over-tour and play way too much, yeah, and it actually hurts their draw and their guarantees.
Yeah,
I've seen the opposite. Sometimes less is more. Bigger crowds, better money. Like you just said before, you never expected you'd sell out the Greek, and you did.
Yeah,
so absence makes the heart grow a little fonder sometimes.
Yeah, it's a bunch of factors, and all of the things you just said are very true. You
yeah
have to weigh all that up, because at the end of the day, it is, as much as I love doing it, at the end of the day, it is a business. It's show business, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, and there's so much out there these days because everybody has to tour because record sales aren't what they were.
And
sometimes the fans get fatigued. Oh, them again, you know?
Well, there's that. And last time I checked, they haven't added any more days to the week. There's still only 7 of them.
Yeah.
And like bands who've reformed, there's new bands. There's bands who've broken up and reformed again. Everybody had reason. And there's still only 7 days in a week.
Right. 5 farewell tours.
You know what I mean?
Look at the Misfits. They found that the best formula ever. Don't play for 30 years.
Right.
Come out, do like 10 arena shows and then go away again.
Yeah.
It's, you know, if you can get yourself in fighting shape, you know, to go out and do that, God bless, you know.
Let's get a couple quick calls in before we have to wrap up. Greg in Houston's been waiting since we started the show. Greg, go ahead. You're on with Billy. You just need those headphones, Billy, so you can hear him. Hey, Greg.
Hey, thanks, Eddie. Billy, it's a true pleasure to talk to you, sir. I've been a fan since the Love Record, and congratulations on the 30th anniversary of Sonic Temple.
Well, thanks, Greg. Houston, we have a soft spot for Houston, Texas, because when we first came to America, before the Love album, we played a club called Numbers in Houston, was a famous... Right? You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. It's an institution, yes. I saw many shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so to me, an English guy, I never, you know, I didn't even know Texas. I, you know, it was all whatever. I was like, wow. I didn't know they were so progressive. So it was fun, man. So God
Greg,
bless.
Your phone is real crackly, so ask your question real quick, and I'm going to hang up on you because your phone's making noise.
Absolutely. I just wanted to see if Billy could elaborate a little bit on the songwriting process that he and Ian go through when they're writing a new record. And Billy, thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Songwriting, it's a trip. It's evolved. I mean, now in the old days, in the 80s, we'd knock up a new song in the sound check and play it at the gig and, you know, hey, what do you think of our new song? For some reason, that's all died off now. So we, you know, it's a collaborative thing with the Cult. There aren't really Ian songs and Billy songs. We just write together. Obviously, certain songs have more of my DNA than Ian's, you know, but we're a collaborative thing, which makes it vital that we have a strong producer to kind of be able to get both of us satisfied. You know, so it's a bit of a balancing act and trying to find the commonality between where we're at. You know, Ian's very progressive in his thinking, his musical taste. He always wants to go forwards. I'm a bit more conservative by nature. I'm a guitar player, so, you know, I just want to play lots of loud guitar. So we try and factor all those things in together and try and make records that sound like they're of their time. You know, I don't want to keep making... It would be inauthentic for us to try and make electric again because I'm not that 24-year-old drunk guy. It would be a fantasy to even think it. So that's the only thing with the process of writing songs and quantity not... quantity,
quality, not quantity.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right? You want the opposite, right?
Yeah, it's the headphones that kill me. I go all weird, like I feel like I'm in a submarine.
But the other thing that I think is really interesting, Billy, is not only the songwriting partnership you have with Ian, but just the relationship in general. Not many things last as long as you've had a partnership with this guy. It's pretty remarkable.
I know we're born a year and 2 days apart. We're both the same birth sign. We're very similar in a lot of ways and very different in others. And I think I'm just count my blessings that I ever met the guy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's an amazing gift to be able to meet somebody who collaboratively together, the two of you make something
right
that you couldn't make individually, you know, and all the great bands, most of the great bands have that dynamic between two guys. I think 2 + 2 = 5.
Let me squeeze in a couple more quick calls because we're almost out of time and people have been waiting. This is Nat in New Orleans. Go ahead, Nat.
How you doing, Billy? I'm an Arsenal fan.
Hey, all right, Nat. Hey.
Yeah, I'm an Arsenal fan. But anyways, I was in the Marine Corps in the 80s and got that Southern Death Cult and followed you all the way to Sonic Temple. And last year, finally, I got to see you guys. I took 10 friends at the IP Casino in Biloxi, Mississippi. And saw a wonderful concert. I just want to thank you guys for still playing. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks for your service. I always like
for
to
sure.
Say that. Thanks
absolutely
for your service. And thanks for being there for us. I like playing Biloxi. I never thought, as a young man in England, I'd be ever playing in Biloxi, Mississippi. I'll tell you a little story quickly, 15 seconds. The name Southern Death Cult is an anthropological term for tribes of American Indians from that part of America, specifically near Biloxi, who worship burial mounds and stuff.
Oh, wow.
Like a lot of ancient people did all over the world and in Europe and all this. But they were there, and that's how somehow that name, which obviously is the precursor of the Cult, was the Southern Death Cult. It was a different band, but so there's a Biloxi connection.
Interesting. Let's go to Ben, who's in Canada. Ben, go ahead. You're on with Billy Duffy.
Hey, man, it's Sven, long-time listener, first-time caller. Love the show, Eddie. Billy, it's great to talk to you. I just wanted to leave a comment.
Thanks, Sven.
Got to see you here. Got to see you up here in Vancouver a couple months ago. I believe it was at the Bowl for the Orpheum. Awesome show. Loved it. Being a fan since back in the Love album days. Saw you at Pine Knob when Sauna Temple came out back in Detroit area. And I have to agree with you, the strip clubs were a thing of beauty in the 90s here in Vancouver, weren't they?
Yeah.
They were guilty. Awesome.
Guilty as charged.
Off the air. Okay.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it, man. Take care. I've heard much about those. I've never partaken, but I've heard
of
much
course,
about what goes on in Vancouver. I've never been to Vancouver, so I don't know. But anyway, thank you, Sven, for the call. Thank you to all the callers. It was I'm sorry we ran out of time, didn't get a chance to get to more. And thanks to all my guests throughout the week. It's been an amazing week. And Billy, thank you for coming in, man. And Sonic Temple, so maybe some more shows next year?
We're going to. The original tour for Sonic Temple was very lengthy. We did 50 or 60 shows with Metallica alone to support the album, let alone the own shows we did on our own afterwards. And
right.
So we're going to keep going, and certainly all of 2020, I think at the end of next year, we'll probably, bring the curtain down on the whole thing. But I think we've got another year of it. There's places we want to go to. And
new music cooking?
Yep. We're working on some new stuff. Had a conversation about this morning. So we're always simmering. Again, quality, not quantity.
Yeah, that's it. Good time talking to Billy Duffy. Appreciate him coming in. And again, that interview courtesy of Trunk Nation, my daily radio show heard live on Sirius XM Volume 106 every day, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, and the replay every night, 10 to midnight Eastern, or of course, anytime you want, on demand on the Sirius XM app. If you're listening in the U.S. or Canada, please look into joining me for Trunk Nation and hear everything I'm doing daily, including all the great interviews, and become a subscriber of Trunk Nation and Sirius XM. You get a little taste here on the podcast each and every week. Thanks to Katie Irizarry. She is the producer of the Eddie Trunk podcast, and I will see you next week for another all-new episode free, as always, at podcastone.com and, of course, Apple Podcasts. Have a good one.
Shoots ready.
Boy, the things I go through to get auto loan rates as low as 1.04% APR for 36 months on new vehicles with PenFed.
You are aware that you don't have to be a military member to save hundreds on your auto loan, aren't you? Anyone can join PenFed.
As someone terrified of heights, I probably should have looked into that.
Probably.
Drop me off at the shore.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/autos or call 1-800-247-5626. Advertised rates available through the PenFed Car Buying Service. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.